question about the witch's sin.
Mm-hmm.
Is it concerned with the prevention of uncontrolled magic taking place? Magic, as was explained in the magicians, is magic taking place without awareness when resentments are resent, you know, things like that?
No, not really. If we draw the sieve and put a make his perspective out of it, probably, but the bottom of it is grilled, isn't it? Wire. And this is the same diagram as the formal inspin and the divisions we did before. If we consider the form in here without the substantiality of it, just a form, like considering a man's idea of himself as opposed to his actual capacity, we can call that the sieve. And witches were said to be able to go to sea in a sieve, weren't they? And the method of doing it in the fairy story is first bung up all the holes with clay. And some people think it's cheating, don't they? But clay is the principle of gross materiality. So what it means is that to make your ideas effectual, you will have to incarnate them. So you have to fill the bottom of the sieve with clay before you can swim or boat on it in your experiential life. Really, it's another way of talking about the incarnation. A lot of people have got ideas, and that is the mesh of form. In fact, everybody has the same number of ideas. But the question of actualizing them is another point. And in order to actualize them, you must get into the gross material experience. In other words, you cannot become a real being unless you expose yourself to the lowest kind of situation there is, and is a gross material one. You know, the word fantasy, the fantasia of the Greeks, is the word that the Latins would call imagination. And it has two meanings. One is a negative, and the other is positive. In its negative state, it is the kind of process that goes on inside your mind when you are not controlling yourself. And we call it, in general, daydreaming, in which a person may sit down and imagine that he's being presented at court and greeted with high honours, and almost approaching vaguely through the mind. That's its negative aspect. But there's another aspect where you deliberately conceive such things and examine all the inherent steps to fulfilling it, and then you begin the gross material operation which will ensure that you are able to do that in the material world. And we said that word magic is the mar root, which is appetite, and gay, the Greek gamma, the gimel of the Hebrews, will shade it dark because it means gross dark matter. So mar into gay means by act of will drive the appetite into the gross material world to ratify in material activity your will purpose. This at the end process is the intellectual aspect of it. So if you like, we could put these two in opposition and write ik at the top, ma at the bottom, and the gay between, that's the circle, established by an intellectual proposition and an application of will. That's in your head, that's your belly, that's the chest, out of which your arms grow, don't they? And the arms in the Bible are equivalent to the executive power. They terminate in the hand of the manipulators. But the thing is to realize that they grow out of this feeling zone. And that feeling zone will never grow properly unless you jam it between two different things, a gross material fact and an intellectual idea. The intellectual idea gives you the form, and the will from below applying hammers the feeling until it comes out on your executive manipulators, and you then arrange the material situation according to your will, guided by the idea you have. The whole process then means magical. So this witch's sieve thing means incarnation of the will, gross materialization of the will. It's another aspect of taking the low road, the empirical road of the scientist, which is a sure road, although it is a slow road. Slow and low are the same word, aren't they? The quick way is to see all the rationale of it. That's the high road. But it requires a colossal amount of energy to do that. Most people can't do it. The ancients said of it that it is so hard to think that rather than think, people do things. They would rather go to Africa to see what there is there than think what there must be there from first considerations. If we say take the earth, there's an equator, there's a sun over here, the rays of the sun falling on the earth. If we take the rays falling over the equator where it is vertical, it is very hot necessarily. And as the rays are falling horizontally here, the curvature of the earth is spreading those rays over a larger area, and therefore there's less and less heat as the earth turns away. So from first principles, we know if we want to find a hot country, we should go to where the rays of the sun are vertical, shouldn't we? But it requires a little bit to gather yourself together to think such a thing. Now in the same way, once upon a time, this earth was an incandescent mass of gas, wasn't it? And inside that sphere, a gaseous incandescent sphere, were, in the form of light, all the chemicals which later solidified and became the earth. And they've all got different velocities and different specific gravities. And as the earth is spinning, it acts like a centrifuge. So it must dispose all the different atoms of different specific gravities at different points along the latitudes, because it must fling heavy substances and so on. So there must be a gradient along there of specific substances. Gold, silver, copper, and so on should form in certain bands around the earth, shouldn't they? So if you work very hard, you should know where to go to dig for gold. The empirical way is to go all over the world and dig everywhere. And sometimes you have a lucky find. But if you're very careful in your reasoning, you can say where it must be. Now, if you remember that all the distribution of forces on the earth, if the earth were a perfect sphere and were static, then there would be no centrifugal force acting on it. Therefore, it would not act like a centrifuge and separate the different specific gravities. But it isn't like that, and therefore we say it's not a homogeneous sphere. Already, it is heterogeneous. It has flung out all the differences by the mere act of rotating. But it not only rotates on its axis, it is also going around the sun, and the sun is going around another point. So there's a kind of centrifugal force acting across the earth from south to north, which has caused the land mass itself to drift towards the North Pole. So if you look at the South Pole, it's relatively all sea. If you look at the North Pole, it's relatively all land. So we know that the real centre of the land mass has drifted above this conceptual equator. So after we made our rationale for a static sphere, which would be homogeneous, and then we imagine it to spin, it would rotate and fling out all the atoms of different weights, putting the heaviest ones on the equator, and allowing the others to arrange themselves alongside, then we have to make an allowance for the drift of the land masses north. And when we've made that allowance, we then know approximately where to look for gold in certain bands or any other substance like that. And some of our very best geologists are aware of this general principle. So they stand as advisors to the others who don't know that and say, we recommend that you take your equipment to so-and-so and make research there. Just like they do in the case of finding oil, it depends on certain rock strata. But certain principles, those principles, if understood thoroughly, enable you to work out something without empirical investigation. For instance, if you could see that if a person is covetous, then all the forces in the body are coming into the body all the time. Now, if you once allow that there is a centripetal a spin onto the centre, a pressure onto the centre in a covetous person, because covetousness is an act of will, and will is power, and is causing a drift, you would expect over a period of years a compaction of that person. You'd expect that person to become slightly smaller. Now, if you work this out very, very carefully in isolation, then put it in an environment, you can work out what has happened in a given case. For instance, some people suddenly start shrinking, and it has to do with this contraction. Frequently, lack of security makes them hang on, and they drive as soon as they've got onto a centre. It causes hardening of certain parts of the body by driving onto those centres. But you can see that you have to understand your basic principles thoroughly. So the important thing to realise is this simple fact that it is very, very hard to think. The Germans say, träumen ist leicht, denken ist schwer. Dreaming is very easy and thinking is difficult. So because of that fact, we have to bung up the sieve with clay, which is the same thing as going into the gross material world and getting experience. A man might, say, learn all Harvey's theory of the circulation of the blood. He might study all the books on it, find out what has been done since, so that he's got a concept in his mind of what it is like in general. But no two individual people are built in quite the same way. So if he came to operate on that system, he would still need to keep his eyes open to the gross material situation. He would have a general plan, but the gross material fact would be distorted. So we say that as far as spirit is concerned, it is pure law. And as far as the gross material world is concerned, that appears to be lawful because it is nearly dead. It can't break the law. But when we come into the psychic world, it appears that the law doesn't hold at all, because the soul can like and dislike and wriggle. So then at the top level we have spirit, which is pure law. At the bottom level we have an appearance of conformity in the material world, which does not appear to break laws because it's nearly dead, so the law of gravity holds. And in the psychic world we have the soul liking and disliking aspects of the law above and the mass inertia below, and wriggling and producing an appearance of freedom between those two kinds of law. So that is the important thing to realise. Man walks on two legs, is a way of expressing it. Man walks on two legs. He has his right leg, the will side of his being, the left leg, the idea side of his being, and he has to put down the will and the idea and guide his will with the idea. And where he cannot work it out from first principle, then he must expose himself and put the feet on the earth and will into a material situation and use the empirically derived ideas of material situation and balance those against the universal formal principle. And then he's like The sphere, the Platonic concept of a man, is a sphere of form, a soul, with legs on it so that you can walk about on the earth. But remember that the more you understand about universal logic, the more clear you are about the particular situation, because the particular situation is merely a little part. Particle means little part. So a particular situation is simply a little part of the universal situation. And the particulars are no more than precipitations of the universal law. So the more you know about the universal law, the more easy it becomes to handle a particular situation. If we remember what we said about taxic theory, about the tendency of living substance to move towards pleasures and away from pains, then we don't need to examine 2,000 million people in the world to know that if we creep behind them and stick a pin in them suddenly, most of them will jump. We will find some that don't. They're suffering from anesthesia of some kind. But there'll be relatively few. So that this universal law will apply over most cases. And where it doesn't, you have to keep your physical eye open and discover by using your sense organs and adding to it your reason why this thing is not occurring in conformity with the universe. About magic, which you mentioned before, that in the sense of uncontrolled magic, this is not the meaning of the sin, but it is a very important idea, because people are always making magic in an uncontrolled way. Most psychologists call it suggestion, don't they? They say that people are suffering from suggestions. We've got two kinds: auto-suggestion, the kind you do on yourself; hetero-suggestion, the kind somebody else does on you, or you do on somebody else. But when it is unconscious, it is dangerous.
Wondering whether that was actually happening in the case of a person that wasn't aware.
It's happening all the time with everybody on everybody. A concrete example. If I'm limping, I think I can get away with things. What he had noticed was that somehow, for some reason, a person that limped appeared to be getting away with things that other people who didn't limp could not get away with. So I'll try this kind of magic. Now, everything is a suggestion. Your physical behavior is a suggestion. It's like those iatrogenic diseases. You train a man in a certain way to look for certain symptoms in anything, whether it's in medicine or in engineering. You find an engineer and he listens to a pinching sound, and he's been told that that sound means a certain kind of encrustation under a cylinder head or something. He's listening with an idea to control what he's listening for. And it's a very important rule: we find what we are looking for. So the concept that we have in our mind, the concept that we think rules the world, is the thing we will look for, and we will find evidence for it, because there is evidence for everything. I was talking to a psychiatrist last Sunday about this fact, because I gave him an exercise to do with colour selection. We went out in the car down the road and said, now we will look for the colour red. And as we went down the road, he looked, and suddenly there was a red van and a red pillar box and a lady with a red coat and a man with a red face. They all began to bounce out because we had said we are looking for red. And we said, now we will look for green. And then red became unimportant. When we looked for blue, it appeared that blue came through the haze. When we looked for red, we could see the bricks in the distance in buildings shining through the mist. You always see what you're looking for. And if you believe that there is a trick of life somewhere, you will start looking for it. And this is really the beginning of getting on the right road, because there is a trick of life. When you begin to look for it, you begin to find it. Plato once said that in the ancient days, people believed that myths were true. When they believed they were true, they read them and thought about them. When they thought about them, they got the benefit, and when they got the benefit of mythic knowledge, they became healthy and happy and lived a very long time. But after a long time, it became apparent that if a man understood all mythology, you could not twist him. So that the distribution of wealth began to equalize itself out. So some fellows thought, well, it's not good to allow this mythic knowledge to spread about because we can't deceive anybody. So what we want to do is discredit the myths and say they are rubbish. So they began a process of myth discrediting. Because really a myth is a view of the universe in its origins which is quite true, properly understood. So they proceeded to discredit the myths, and in due course the myths were discredited. Now when the myths were discredited, people didn't know which way to go for a rule of life. And they stopped looking at the myths and began to look elsewhere. They became confused. Then the men that had discredited them started building temples of mysteries and offering to initiate other men for mula, for mela, for honey, for money. And the men who had ignored the myths, which contained all the secrets of the mysteries, now went and paid to be initiated into the mysteries that they had lost. And so the power began to drift into the hands of a few, who from that day have had, well, certainly 6,000 years of misrepresentation of these fundamental truths of the universe. So if you know what you're looking for, you can begin to see it. One of the etymologies given and defined as a fanciful derivation of Plato's, chronos, time, from choros and nous. Choros is the same as the word chorus. It's derived from going round. This nous is this flying in of spirit. So choros nous, chronos, means time. It means to rotate. Intelligence rotating is time. Now the philosophers who say that is a fanciful derivation are either fools or rogues. Some of them are fools. Some of them deliberately misrepresent it. Because if you understand what time is, like a man said in the Arabian Nights, one of the princes, if you understand what time is, don't tell anybody. Because if people find out what time is, they will start wondering what to do with it. But if they have no idea what it is, it will just pass before them. And they will go round and round in the groove of time. On the way up, we were talking in the car about the projection of your future out of your past by not realizing that life is a cyclic process. We're talking about the philosophy of Bergson. A Bergson has a philosophy called emergent evolutionism, and he postulates that there is an infinity of duration behind us, temporal duration, and it substantiates itself into the present, but there is no future. The future is always simply the present pushing forward with the weight of the past on it. Now, it is really half a circle. Bergson means son of a mountain. It's an old name for a river. And the river that runs down the mountain into the sea is half of the story. And it appears there is an enorme vitale going down, the life force rushing down the mountain. We call it gravity, we don't call it life force. He thought that it was this vital force tearing down the mountain willfully and going on its way to the sea. But he forgot about the evaporation of the sea, the ascent of that moisture as clouds, the travelling of the clouds to the mountain, and the falling again onto the mountain to make the same river. So he talks about only half a circle, so we say he has an eternity truncated in the present.
Backwards there is a perpetual duration, forwards there is nothing, and the present is pushing continuously into a non-existent future. That's Bergson's analysis. It has faults in it because it was only a half a circle. But if we remember that the circle is complete, we can see that from the moment a child is born, it is already characterized in its fundamentals. And a very ancient statement says, character is destiny. Now, character is form. The idea of charring, the charring effect, you know, charring is burned in by experience. When a child is born, it has these genetic factors of form from the ancestors which have been put into the child's body. So the child is already characterized by certain tendencies to act, to feel, to think in a certain way.
Well, isn't that a kind of magical magic that's come over, that's caused him to come
over? By definition, because it is appetite which has established itself. We know that if we persuade the parents to behave in a certain way, they will change their chemistry. If they change their chemistry, if a man changes his chemistry through various phases, that man is creating individual sperms in himself which have a certain amount of chemical coverage, which is the reflex of his then condition. For instance, Gandhi says in his autobiography, talking about his first son, who disagrees with Gandhi's principle completely, "When I remember my condition when he was conceived, I am not surprised that he disagrees with me." Because he precipitates a chemical which is a stimulus, an environment, inside, in the chromosomes of that egg. There is form, but round that nucleus, there is environment, chemical. And the child has to work to his environment. And its first environment is his physical body, isn't it? And further, if the mother is in an unbalanced state, then her chemistry is peculiar, and her blood is circulating through the body of that child, isn't it? So we can upset the child by upsetting the mother. It's actually possible for a woman feeding a child on the breast to poison the child through the milk if we annoy the mother sufficiently by making these chemical changes. And the baby has tummy trouble. And these things really occur. The universe is not made of discrete particles. This is very important. It's entirely an abstract idea to believe that individuals are totally separate. They are not. The universe is a continuum, and therefore every part of it is not disjoined from every other part. So every part influences all, and all influences each. So the whole magical process is first primary appetite, producing the gross world, first the subtle world, then the gross world, then pressing through the gross world, it constructs back again the world of ideas to experience, and in the process of condensation it is making chemical precipitates. The chemicals we find in the earth were once, as you know, incandescent gases in a big sphere, and before that they were diffused. That sphere was gathering together light. Matter is condensed light. We know this because by spectrum analysis of a distant star or a planet, we can tell the chemical constitution by analysing the light. That means that matter is condensed light. In the same way, light and consciousness are very closely related. So that when we think about our consciousness, we're thinking about the light in us. In fact, if you look in your mind, when you see an idea, you will see it against the background. It is a certain kind of light. We call it the light of the mind. It is not merely a metaphor. There is a mental light. There is also a light, a certain frequency called the astral light, which is the light of idea coloured by desire. Because you know that if you desire something, you don't see it in quite the same way as if you detest it. The same fact. Children are thoroughly aware of that because they run about in a funny world where there are halos around the things they like they actually see them. If you could remember back when you were very, very tiny, you'd find that you never focus on the edge of a person's physical body, but you focus on a whole effect, and that you saw everybody, including an aura of light, which gave you a certain impression. And then gradually you condense your consciousness onto the gross material part of the body, and that's the same thing as the Adamic fall. To fall out of the consciousness of the whole universe onto the physical body, and then believe that particulars are separate and that you can deal with them separately in isolation without affecting other beings. That's the man that thinks he's isolated, thinks that he can gather things without affecting other people. But even psychologically, there's a stimulus there, so that when other people see what he's doing, they think, is it worth doing? We'll join in. Start a new campaign in business, and the first thing the boys from Blackpool will arrive and examine it, see if it's sellable. If it is, steal the design and go away. And before you've got time to get your patent in full operation, they have already flooded the market. It doesn't matter what it's in. If it has a value, everybody is already looking, and they see what they're looking for. They're looking for value. If it has a value, then the Hawkeye value seekers will find it. Where the body is, there will the eagles be gathered together. So, the universal magic which made the universe also made internal to it the parts of the universe. And the soul of a man is only a part of universal spirit. And it is not disconnected in any way whatever. There's no space between two souls. There is only a resonance difference. Just as we say that the radio waves from different stations in the world, in this room now, are not spatially discrete. There is no voidity between them. They're actually vibrating in the same ether, and the only reason that they don't interfere is because they have different numbers of impulses per second. So we say that the gross material world is the world of apparently discrete entities, but the spiritual world is the world of compenetration, where everything is inside everything else. And you know that, I think it's about 5 years ago, it was discovered quite accidentally in subatomic experiments, that even gross materials, like mineral crystals, like diamonds and so on, can be telescoped together under sufficient pressures. So if you get two diamonds, put them together, and bang them hard enough, they suddenly slip into each other, and you then have one with the mass resultant, the weight of the previous two, that were banged together. And they say, well, this is because it's a kind of grid, it's nearly all space and energy. But really, it isn't that, it's a resonance. Each being is a way of vibrating. And the persistent way one thing vibrates and another thing vibrates is the only thing that keeps them apart. So the magic consists really in knowing the laws of resonance. If you know it in the case of ideas, if we say, let's all think about politics. The moment we set the frame of reference, we say politics, we have excluded for the time being science, philosophy, religion. Politics is the frame of reference. It conditions what the mind shall look for. And if you know that fact, then you can utter a word which is a frame of reference to someone, and the mind of that person starts looking within the defined frame. And you then insert into that frame certain other ideas which the person is then forced to examine because he accepted the original frame. That's the method of propaganda, isn't it? And one of the most obvious methods is to take a universal idea and attach to it a particular corporeal punishment. In other words, take an idea like the absolute equality of all beings. Call it politically communism, like the Christians practiced in the very first 50 years of Christianity, when they had all things in common, it says in the Acts. All things in common, and they lived as if they were one man. and they call themselves the sons of one man, in the cosmic man. Now, then get hold of a man and give him a good beating physically, and then say to the people, the man we have just beaten was a communist. We've tied together two things, one a universal communism, the other one a particular, a man that we know has solid, gross material flesh and blood. And then we beat the flesh and blood, which makes everybody identify with it, and think they're being beaten, or could be. And we say, this is what happens if you accept that universal idea of communism. Straight away there arises a revolt against the term communism. They've now got a frame of reference in their mind, communism, plus an example, namely gross material suffering. And the next time they see the word communism, they have a little twinge unconsciously, and it appears on the surface, I don't like communism. And this is a deliberate scheme of governments in propaganda. The Pavlov reflexes in Russia are no more than the same thing, aren't they? Conditioning the reflex. A universal idea has no significance for a baby until you put that baby in a gross material situation and then either tickle it out of the chin and stuff a lolly in its mouth or smack it. So if you say, nice lolly, 10 times tables, you see, then it thinks somehow that those two are linked together. And it does the one to get the other. And this is the whole principle of conditioning. So you can see how easy it is to tie somebody up if the rules are understood. Get a big universal idea, bring it down, find a particular illustration, and then the universal is tainted by that situation. One of the most popular examples of that is the martyrdom of Saint Sebastian. You probably remember the painting. It shows a man on a cross, and round him there are soldiers quite close up to him, the Italian version of the painting, and they're firing at him with bows, and he's full of arrows. If you try to find out who Saint Sebastian was, you can't find him. But it's derived from the Greek word Sebaste, which means one must terrify the people. And the idea was that if you paint a horrible picture like that and say, this is what happens to people who are called martyrs, then people won't want to be one. And the word martyr only means a witness. Doesn't mean anything else. Doesn't mean witness. So if you witness what isn't at all, you're in danger of martyrdom. Now the domain of martyrs is martyrdom. So that wherever there are witnesses, that is martyrdom. Technically, people don't know that. They think it means being stretched on racks or filled with arrows or having your boot made of iron and your leg put in it and then lead poured in to help it fit. These are all methods of frightening people into subjection. They have not disappeared from the world. You know, that recent Algerian affair shows you that those things are still with us. But one example is enough, and the one that you catch and use is called the scapegoat. And we don't have to manufacture them artificially, because the world already has a lot of people in it running about and misbehaving through lack of control. When the government wishes to use one, then it selects one. But there are plenty of them. The important thing is to understand the principle involved, that you can make a universal which has no emotion at all, load it with emotion by illustrating it in a gross material picture allied to great pains or sometimes to pleasures. And the whole process is the conditioning of the primary appetite, the ma, by a gross situation controlled as an idea. The whole process being magical.
Oh.
one of the things that I'm not sure that I've asked is whether the state of the feeling and thought at the time of death would determine in any way where you would come out on the zodiacal wheel and you were born, if there was any connection of any kind there and this magical principle.
Well, you know, when Gautama was asked the same question, he said, "This question does not edify." What he meant to say was, it's a nice thought, and there's something in it, but can you use it immediately? You see? Nevertheless, we'll consider it for a moment. It may be edifying today, whereas it may not have been edifying in India in the 5th century BC. If you consider very carefully that all your actions are conditioned by previous activities, either of yourself or of somebody in your environment, as teachers, educators, parents, or your ancestors, or the whole weight of the tradition of society, once you've seen clearly that action results from form pushed by will, which is the cause of action, isn't it? Form being precipitated into the gross material world. Once you've accepted that in principle, then you can solve this other problem. Now, there is a doctrine called the doctrine of the eternal recurrence. And it is a very simple doctrine, but difficult to understand because it is simple. We have very complex minds, and to reduce our minds to a fundamentally simple idea requires very hard work. In the eternal recurrence, you have to understand what time is. Now, the Earth on a Monday isn't in the same position as it is on Tuesday, is it? Because in one year it goes a full circle around the Sun. But the Sun is also on the move. And if we remember that action is a modal operation of power in space, and that the Earth on a Monday and a Tuesday and a Wednesday is in a different space, then we can say in the place where the Earth was last Monday, there is still Monday as a vibrational fact, not a mere potentiality. So that if a man at the point of death remembered a girlfriend that he had who was very kind to him, he doesn't incarnate in another life ahead of himself. He wheels back into the very same resonance pattern, not another one, the same one. So his life becomes identical because he's gone back into the same place. If you can see that the extension of space infinitely contains all formal actualities in that big sphere, and that each place, Christ says, every man goes into his own place, each place is a form of activity. And you can become so attached to certain places that at the cessation of your physical life, your desire for that same experience is so strong that it whips you back into exactly the same situation that you were in before.
It is a principle of magic that's caused you to go back.
But magic is only the establishment of your will. Now the whole question is how to avoid this repetition, the eternal recurrence. Friedrich Nietzsche was obsessed with this idea, and he said, obviously, the only thing to do with it is so live your life that you can afford to do it eternally in an identical manner. Now, that requires what we call this power, the epistrophane of Plato, the ability to turn back on yourself and say, have I done this before? Was it worth it?
This is very, very important to get that sentence in your brain box. Have I done it before? Was it worth it? Did it give me what I wanted? Something is on your tongue, you're about to say it. Before you say it, say, what am I going to say? Why am I going to say it? Is it going to produce the result that I want? If it is not, stop it. Because if you don't, it is part of the cycle that was laid by the previous magic of your ancestors and you. So the only way you can escape from the dictatorship of tradition and of your ancestors is this epistrophe, this back-turning of yourself on yourself, serpent with his tail in his mouth, and he bites himself and says, I am doing the biting, not the ancestors. To do it, you must have the right verbal form. So you must say to yourself, I am turning back to examine inside myself my action tendency. If there is an inclination in me, it proves previous experience somewhere. Because I cannot have an inclination in a situation about which I know nothing. For instance, if I say to you, how would you like to eat that, what is it, from the jungles of, where is it? That, well, how would you like it?
I don't know what it is.
You don't know what it is. Now, it's very, very important, you see. You don't know anything about it unless you had some experience. But supposing I said that the thing I was thinking about was a pineapple, then immediately there arises a feeling relationship. Either you like it or you don't. Maybe you like the inside and you don't like the outside. Maybe you've never eaten that tuft on the top. You see? But there arises a feeling relation with it when you know something about it. This is why Socrates said, all learning is remembering. The doctrine of anamnesis is the idea that you are, as a soul, perfect and whole and omniscient before you get pushed into a body. Once you get put in a body, you are battered by sense impressions from outside and you forget your omniscience and you become serialized. In that dianoic process, discursive reasoning begins. And as long as you're reasoning discursively, then you cannot grasp that whole sphere which you were originally. In order to regain your omniscience, first of all, you must find out the inclination in yourself and stop it. Subject to that big rule, don't spoil your vehicle of experience. Don't destroy your body. Subject to that rule, if you feel inclined to do something, don't. If you feel inclined not to do it, do. And that quite independently of whether it's what you call a good act or a bad act. Because there is really only one evil, and that is slavery. And some people can't help patting a small child on the head as they go down the street. So if you put a row of children down the street, the hand will go like that and on the head. It would feel terrible if it missed one. That's mechanics, isn't it? And we say there is no inertia other than the inertia of previously established will. That means that every inclination we've got proves that we have already done something like it before. We've forgotten where and when, but we have done it, because as we said, the proof is you don't know whether you want to eat that thing unless I tell you what it is. So if you once realize that bondage is bondage to your memory, if it's a worthless weight of the memory dictating to you, then you would really be free. And it requires this continuous backspin of the conscience, back away from the external environment where the stimulus comes from. Something comes at you, as it comes in, catch it. And first of all, stop the immediate reaction. Otherwise it's a simple loop out, a knee jerk. Turn it round, let it rotate, look at it, and say, what is the meaning of this stimulus? Am I inclined to respond by destructive activity or constructive activity?
Do I want to go to it or go away from it? Ask yourself those questions and be absolutely honest with yourself. There is nobody pulling your own leg. It may be useful to pull somebody else's. If you do that, you discover that most of the things that you tend to do, you do not want to do. You will say, they won't lead me towards freedom. And as it is freedom we have defined as the thing we are pursuing, and we know that freedom ultimately means the gaining of the end. Seek first the kingdom of heaven and all things will be added. Heaven is equilibration of power, and it is only in the balance of power that freedom consists, not in inclination. When you are vertical, you are not inclined and you are free. When you incline, gravity gets you. You fall. So really, when a man is upright, the upright man and the moralist, if that man allows himself to incline, he is responsible for the inclination. He is not responsible for the fact that once he's inclined, he falls flat on his face. He's only responsible for the inclination of the will. This is why in Christianity, before Christianity, it didn't happen. But in Christianity, what became important was not whether you do a thing or don't do a thing, but whether your will inclined to do it or not to do it. See, prior to Christianity, the statement about morality was, it is action, good or bad. With Christianity, when Christ said, the man that looks at that lady and wants to take her out, even though he lacks the opportunity, is guilty. What he meant to say was that the inclination is there, and if it is not killed, even if he doesn't manage to take that one out now because she's married and with hubby, nevertheless, the same instinct, with a slight change of environment, will take him to a newsreel or something. So that the inclination of the will is the thing we are responsible for. Now, often the person is aware of that internally today, but they did not used to be aware of it. Before 2,000 years ago, they weren't aware of it. They actually thought, because their governing concept was action is either right or wrong. If you look at Plato, you'll find he defines the good as the efficient. And the good is the efficient as defined by Plato. That is to say, a good screwdriver is one that turns screw, and a bad one is one that won't. And that is not really a moral statement at all. And it's not an ethical statement, and it isn't a spiritual statement. It is a statement about fitness for purpose. And when we come to the work of magic, the work of changing yourself, which is an act of will, it can only be in the initial inclination of the will. Do you want to be free or not? If we say to some people, do you want to be free? You say, what's free? He doesn't know. If we define very carefully for him what freedom means and the absence of it, supposing we say, well, if you are free, other people can't push you around. And supposing he's a very negative character and says, but I like being pushed around. Because I don't push myself around very well, and other people push me around and make me go and enjoy myself. They push me into pubs and parties and all sorts. So, to that fellow, the negative fellow, to be free is not a thing he desires, because he is on pleasure bent, and therefore he does not want to come out of it by his own efforts. The only man that can prefer freedom is a man who has already been in some kind of bondage. So unless you fall down when you're a kid, you're running on the road, if you don't fall down on the gravel and cut your knees a bit, and you won't run with any degree of care. Care, the ability to carry yourself, watchfulness, arises only from suffering. This means to say that if you had all your own way from the moment you were born, you would be an obnoxious creature with no understanding, no compassion, nothing. You would be inhuman because you had never failed. Therefore, you could not understand in other people why they failed. for which purpose all the souls are put into gross material bodies, which are automatically inefficient, and because it's inefficient and separates the being involved in it from its good, it is called a body of sin. Sin means separation, it doesn't mean anything else. When you are separated, disintegrated, cut off from your good, then that is sin. So when it's called the body of sin, it means that it is the means whereby you are separated. But if you do not suffer, and suffer means to be passive, suffer a stimulus, so that the stimulus conditions your activity, so that you are not free, and as a result of your lack of freedom you suffer pain, and the pain makes you wish that you had more control, and you find you haven't got it because no man can get it unless God wills. When you have suffered enough pain, you begin to realize that all the other sufferers round about you are in the same boat. There then begins to arise compassion in you for those other people. And that isn't the same thing as sentimentality. Genuine compassion for genuine suffering. When that has arisen, it then becomes no longer necessary for you to suffer in the same way. But until you get that universal compassion, it is inevitable that you will make mistakes because you have been put into a body of sin, that is a body of disintegration, your physical body, disintegrated by the five sense messages, in order to educate you for precisely that universal awareness that results in the absolute tolerance of all beings.
That's going to mean the same that until you have sufficient feeling to put you into that place, you can't get that compassion.
That's true. Luckily, most of us don't need to go looking for it, do we? We find it. We don't find as much as we might, you know. If we looked a little farther and a little more often, we might be able to find some little sufferings. And we can do this. We can find the sufferings which are necessary for us, providing we remember that we must not go on an inclination. Because inclination is always to avoid suffering, or to pursue the pleasant.
Would you say that even if you weren't aware of what suffering can do for you, providing you had sufficient of it, it would still happen to you, you would still get that compassion?
Well, when you say you're not aware of it, of course, you mean that relatively, because if we take a brick and hit it with a hammer every day for about, say, 5,000 years, it doesn't become a moral being at the end of that time, and it doesn't develop compassion to other bricks or even to the hammer that's hitting it.
No, but McHugh said that if you're aware of what suffering is happening to you and then you start to look at other people, you get this compassion. Some people suffer and immediately become resentful.
Of the suffering?
Well, of the suffering and even towards other people and things like that, don't they?
Other people have the cause of their suffering. See, if you must suffer, please don't do it where I can see you because you disturb me. That has been said often enough, hasn't it? Take your toothache into the next room, please. You're disturbing me. As long as that stays there, you are bound to be hammered more and more by events.
Well, I think that means actually that the sufferer themselves, instead of getting compassion for those around them suffering, feels resentful and puts the cause of their suffering upon the other beings.
Well, he hasn't suffered enough. And he will get more suffering, because at least he'll cause resentment in the sufferer for lack of sympathy. The important thing to realize is this, that in this concept of the recurrence, you can be attracted by the pleasant and made to go back to the same pub or whatever it was, forever. It runs through the whole of mythology and fairy story lore, that you can go back and repeat yourself through pursuit of pleasure and also pursuit of revenge. You remember the fellow who deprived you, and you determined to do him again.
He, in the meantime, of course, can have evolved.
May have. He may not be there.
No, I mean, if you go back to that situation, are you going to guarantee to find him there?
Well, if you look in the...
That situation.
No. Right, it's another situation. Take you back to somebody else. Well, it happens, hasn't it? Oh, yes. Keeping the dog or something.
Yes.
Or even keeping your farmer because you prefer the farmer.
This is bound up, of course, with the idea of distance again, isn't it? Of keeping your distance from the people that originally you might have, what you called, hated, mm-hmm. that is, you found them close to you, whereas later, when you get a certain amount of compassion, you hold them at a particular distance. But there's a point here that puzzles me, and that is, if you keep people at that particular distance, assuming that you love them and they hate you, where are you in relation to them? On their backs, the same as we said before.
If they hate you?
Say there's a relationship where you genuinely are fond of somebody, you see.
Yeah.
Or should we say genuinely keep them in their right place, mm. wherever they move to. But they are so busy hating you, does that bring you close to them?
As far as they're concerned, but not as far as you're concerned.
You mean you don't notice it?
You wouldn't be there. You see, there's one of the hardest things to understand, that in the spiritual world, where everything is everything, and each is all, and all is each, you can be in two totally different relationships with the same being at the same time. A can hate B, and be obsessed with the presence of B, and B can love A so much that it doesn't even know that A is there because it's thinking about D.
Yeah.
And that happens in the room very, very often.
Right, but I was going to say, what happens in...
See? And that soul at that moment is thinking kind thoughts about that person, at the same time having a nice conversation with another person. You see, distances in spirituality are distances to do with nothing at all in the space-time concept of your gross physical body.
Well, they do work in the gross physical body, don't they? I mean, if we do hate someone, we do find that physically we are invariably coming in contact with them.
Yeah, but you say physically, but really, of course, the physical world is never a cause. Physical things cannot be causes, in that sense.
No, I'm not seeing them as causes, I'm seeing them as...
As facts.
As facts,
yes. Mm. Well, the real cause is the soul state.
Yes.
If you think about somebody and say, I hope I never see him again in all my life, and really mean it,
mm.
you immediately send a message to him that says, I hope I never see you again in all my life. And the father says, what? You say, I must go and see him immediately. In other words, you have biased him.
Yeah.
This is why this state in yoga, vaidagya, means higher indifference.
Mm.
You go beyond hating him, and thereby you are liberated. And yet, you can't deceive yourself. You can't deliberately attain indifference in order to get rid of him. It's an indifference. Mm. Either you attain it, and you are liberated, or you fool yourself, and the fellow knocks on the door. It's tremendously important to understand what it means that space is, in a real sense, spirit. But the usual sense of the word space is an extension which implies a contraction. Suppose when we say there's a certain amount of space and there is a body in it. And we say that body is a contraction of force because we can melt it and it expands.
Mm.
We can heat it more and it becomes a gas and it expands more and more. Suppose when we take a spiral nebula, which is a big mass of gas, twisting in and gradually contracting and going cooler and becoming a world. It's a process of contraction. And when it has contracted, it has obviously exhausted the zone round about it of matter. That exhausted zone we call space, don't we? And this part we call the place, that's the pylor. So the space is the part that has been exhausted. of matter. And the place is that location where a certain kind of activity has been posited. And this is a statement about our sense organs. I look at that pencil and I see carbon there condensed. But if I run an electric current through it, I can turn it into light. I start showing films on the wall with it. Now, when we think of that expanding and becoming light and radiating away, it is travelling through what we call space. But the fun thing about space is not matter, and it has nothing at all to do with matter. Space is spirit, and spirit is absolutely omnipresent, which is the same thing as saying it is solid. There is nowhere where it is not. In this sense, there is no such thing as something not in contact with everything. Because the cause, the final cause, is the end to which everything tends, and the final cause is the same as the beginning. The alpha and the omega, the beginning and the end, are identical. They're both up there, and we go down. If we say there's alpha there and there's omega there, and the process goes right round, and this we call the time process of the soul, and the alpha and omega, the beginning and the end, are identical. So in that sense, there is no concept corresponding to what ordinary people call vacuum, voidity, or emptiness, which are three words in three different languages, all meaning leisure. They only mean leisure, they don't mean anything else. If you get Wilde's dictionary, which is an ordinary single volume dictionary, you will find there, which is quite a popular dictionary, that those three words mean leisure. Now, leisure means this power is laying down. Sure, it's laying down. Must be an Irish power. It is Irish, actually, because Irish means running about in any case. And this power propagates itself absolutely, and yet, being infinite, doesn't go anywhere, because there is nowhere where it is not. This spiritual power is laying down. That is to say, it is apparently passive as far as we are concerned, because we cannot see its activity, we can only see the result at the sense organ level. But the sense organs are specially blinded. Vision, and then a big gap, then hearing, then a big gap, smelling, tasting, touching. There are big gaps in between where man knows nothing. The five sense man is five times ignorant man, isn't he? So there's something going on in the big gaps between his senses. Actually, in the visible spectrum, only 1/27th of all the vibrations is known to us on the eye. In the visible spectrum. So you can see we don't know much. And it's just in these in-between spaces where this power is at leisure. But that's spirit. And it is absolutely solid. And if we want to contact spirit, we have to stop seeing with this physical eye so that we can get into the gap between. We've got to understand all the frequencies. The whole gamut of vibrations with the five big gaps, and the gaps are much bigger than the part we can see, just like an iceberg has more underneath the water than it has showing. So when we think, we call it a final cause, but it is that idea of a good which you have in your mind before you reach it. That we call the final cause. An efficient cause is when you are contemplating a force doing the work. But there aren't any efficient causes other than a final cause, because nothing moves a man or anything else other than its final state towards which it is striving. So the thing that moves an acorn is the oak, perfectly formed. It is that oak which exists eternally, that is literally sucking the earth up through the acorn and making it into the oak shape. So the final cause is always the attained end, the goal towards which you go. So we say the final cause of all action within creation is God. That is good, absolutely. Everything is striving towards good, and that good held inside them is the motive of their striving. And it is that from which we came, and we go down into the time process, and then we go up again. The good mnemonica, which is the ordinary clock face, 12 means governmental perfection. The opposite of is 6, which means section, sexual activity. Now, this is like the zodiac, but on the clock face, the numbers have been taken out of the same diagram that the Chaldeans use, and the zodiacal significances are abstracted and thrown away for consideration. 12 o'clock is 3 times 4, and 3 is spirit, and 4 is matter. So if we say 3, the Trinity, over 4, matter. That's a square, that's a triangle. The triangle is a symbol of fire, which is spirit. The square is a symbol of the earth, because you pack them very closely together. So 3, 4 means spirit and matter, and 3 plus 4 is 7, where 7 means whole. The lot, as they say, means whole. So 12 is the same thing as the whole lot, the Alpha and the Omega. The Alpha and the Omega, the triangle and the square. Now the first thing it does, remember the sign here, we'll put that one in there, the sign of the Ram. Ram is Hebrew for high, the mighty power that differentiates, that rules the substance, Rama. In the Mahabharata of the Hindus, it's personified as Rama, the great hero. Ram, the high energy. First thing it does is make Taurus. Call that one. Unity depends on rotation. There is no unity outside the circle. So if we draw the circle, what is outside is not one, it's infinite. And one means circumscription. One has a boundary. Anyone you've ever seen has limitation, boundary. And what has no boundary is not one. As Shankara, a famous non-dualist in India, refused to call this one, although the Greeks called it one and got into trouble for doing so, because their critics said one has a boundary, and they said, well, the one is the source of all, but one implies duality, because everyone is partible. But this is not partible, this is the paper on which we are drawing. And there's some of it which we've not drawn upon, and underneath that black lead line is some of it still there that we've drawn upon. So the white goes right through the lot, and we call it absolute transcendence, because it goes beyond everything. The white paper is there, underneath that line, and there, and infinitely extending. That is absolute transcendence. In order to make one, it makes a rotation. Sign of Taurus, Taurus Turnus. And we say, therefore, the number one means unity. Now, Christ says, if the seed does not fall to the ground and die, it abides alone. This is the seed. The primary unity, the Hiranyagarbha, the great cosmic egg of the Hindus, is the Logos Spermatikos of the Greeks, the big egg of logic. And therefore we say number one equals unity. If we do not make it die, that is, differentiate it, kill it, divide it, it abides alone. That's logic. If it's all one, and you don't cut it into two, it's going to be on its own, isn't it? So it's going to be very, very lonely. Therefore one of the myths says that God, in the beginning, was on his own, and he was sitting down. And suddenly he thought to himself, good gracious, I'm alone. And he became very afraid, and he thought, I better make myself a wife to talk to. So he cut himself in two. But the other half immediately ran away, saying, I don't want anything to do with you, you're incestuous. And from that running away of the second half arose the time process. That's a mythic statement. If we take that one and cut it in half there, and that too, well, that's a sign of Gemini, isn't it?
So Gemini means count the earth. And you can't count it unless you cut it. You can't count the whole. You have to cut parts and then count.
So this sign of Gemini here, the Gemini, gave earth, means to count. Unity, duality, and the possibility of conflict. So in duality is the possibility of conflict, of strife, of difference of opinion, of right and left, of up and down, near and far. And therefore we say this is the sign of discursive reason. So we say the man born in Gemini tends to discursively reason about things in terms of pairs of opposites. Now when we've got the two halves, and we said that one of the halves, we painted a bit black. She has a black face in some of the myths. She ran away saying, I don't like incestuous fellows. And he pursued her, and being the original, he was a bit tough, and he caught her and generated the world out of the relation. So out of the relation between those two halves, there then arises three. We'll put it down in Roman numerals, and then we'll write the sign of the crab there, because that sign of the crab is simply these two halves trying to catch each other. This one puts an arm around there, and this one puts an arm around there. Those are the claws of the crab. And this one is trying to catch this one and chases it, and this one runs away and says, I'll pull your tail if you pull mine. The result is, it rotates. So we say that the sign of the crab is the first sign of a being substantialized. It represents the soul as a feeling substance. We say it's under the dominion of the moon because of that. It is now a substance, and a person born in that sign is pitched in the fluid content of the body as a feeling being. We've got the meanings now. Governmental perfection is to spirit and matter together. First, creation unity. Second, the analysis of the unity. Third, the synthesis of the unity. Now, there then occurs four. We won't bother about the Roman numeral here. These are four. And we'll draw the square to say
that when that rotation has established itself, it then solidifies, just like that spiral nebula swinging in, condenses and solidifies and becomes Earth. And therefore we say this four is a mark of the established being. And the established being in the zodiac, of course, this position is the Leo position, isn't it? The person of self-will. I must do it my way. And four is the number of that establishment, the number of the square, and passes on logically to the fifth position, which is the five sense circulation system, which is the virgoic position, where the five senses are determining what is happening inside that square of the four. Remember, in the spiritual world, we have to put all these back together again, push them all together, and look at the sphere with them all in. We've analysed them here. We must put them all back together again and see the unity inside infinity, the division inside the unity, the synthesis of the divided inside the unity inside infinity, the establishment, the growth of the five senses as a material experience in the establishment. Then we come to the precipitation or flying out here in Leo. We put a bend in the top one, the bottom one is passive, that's got a bend in. And six is the same thing as sex, Latin S-E-X, sex means six, and six means sex, because this number is, if we look at it in the Hebrew, it's done like that, it's the
sixth letter of the Hindu alphabet. It's the sixth letter in English is F. And in the Hebrewish, thou, thou. And in the Egyptian, the same thing is drawn like this, so you can't miss what it is. And it's shown shooting seeds out. So, this is a phallic sign, and means sex, and is opposite to the absolute. So it means particular generation, as that one means absolute generation. And what it generates then, in the seeds which it shoots out, each little seed is a balanced whole of all the processes that have gone into there. That means every being starts in the universal, comes through a particular, that's Adam, who split into Eve, and Adam and Eve caused trouble, didn't she? And then they had to synthesize the thing by delving and digging and sweat of the brow stuff, like it says in Genesis. And nevertheless, in that process, they became courageous, and thus led the line, which led to the line of Judah, out of which the Messiah comes. Then, through the five sense experience, after being kicked out of the Garden of Eden, they generate sexually, that is in sections, because they, when you're an egg at first, you cut part of it off and say, I'll use that for generations in the future. And you cut it into little bits or sections, each one of which becomes in a woman an egg, and in a man a sperm. So that's section. Then each one of those little sperms or little eggs in a woman is a seven, or S even, spirit even, S even. So that seven means whole, contains all that is right up to there. So we call this stage the fall down to here, from the universal to first precipitate of unity, division of the cell, synthetic or integration of the cell, establishment of the whole body, growth of the five senses, sexual generation, precipitation of a whole being in the seventh phase. And that is 3 plus 4. That was 3 times 4, this is 3 plus 4. So this one, the sign of Andrew's course, multiplication, is compenetration of beings, and this one is plus, you add the beings. Adding is only possible in the time process. In eternity it isn't adding, it's compenetration, but everything is everything else. This brings us to 8. Which is the same relation that there is in that crown, where now there are 2 eggs here. This whole being has to find another. And 8 now means the relation and the eternal process going on. 9 is 6 inverted, and therefore means the negation of sexual activity, and therefore is the number of the magician. Because the magician is the man who inhibits this inclination. The inclination is there. The fall is there. You're responsible for the inclination. That sign of Taurus is a loop. It's the Gordian knot. Any situation that you incline into ties you up. Once you're in it, you have to analyze it. Once you've analyzed it, you have to put it back together again. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. There's the wall he sat on. It's a circular wall. He had a great fall. He fell into there. And then all the king's horses and men couldn't put him together again. He fell right down to the bottom and was broken into millions of little bits or little eggs, each one of which is 7, forced into a relation, 8, and ultimately negated as an individual by his own progeny. So when the first man thought, I will rule the world, and then I will beget children to help me, he got things that didn't help him. So he refuted himself. So that egotism, in the mere fact of trying to propagate itself, always propagates egotism, which hits back at egotism. This is why this world is an educational device.
because it is the sphere into which souls as individuals are precipitated, because they're profoundly egotistic, because they are circumscribed, and they will never consider each other until they are forced into relation. So the egotism refutes itself. Every big boss has to get people to work for him. If he wants a clever manager to control the workers, the clever manager will want to be a director. If he's not careful, and he's a very clever director, he will finish up owning the firm. So you can't really afford to be assisted by two clever people, otherwise you'll be assisting them. And you can never tell really who is the more clever when you're engaging somebody for a particular operation. But the whole process goes right down here, sexual generation, precipitation of your opposition, child, relation between you and it, and the negation of your original purpose. Children always say to their parents, I didn't have to be born, did I? I don't have to be great, do you? You see, you gave me my education for your sake, didn't you? Just to show the neighbours you could. That's kind of funny thing they say, isn't it? All that negates the original egoic precipitation of the first stage. It then becomes 10, which is ordinal perfection.